Welcome to the Jurisdictions Podcast. We're speaking in July 2025 as the one-year mark approaches on the International Court of Justice's advisory opinion on the legal consequences arising from the policies and practices of Israel in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem, where the court stated in its opinion that, amongst other things, and I quote, "The state of Israel's continued presence in the occupied Palestinian territory is unlawful. That is under an obligation to bring to an end its unlawful presence in the occupied Palestinian territory as rapidly as possible. That all states are under an obligation not to recognize as legal the situation arising from the unlawful presence of the state of Israel in the occupied Palestinian territory, not to render aid or assistance in maintaining the situation created by the continued presence of the state of Israel in the occupied Palestinian territory." End of quote. Following this opinion, the UN General Assembly, in a resolution adopted on the 18th of September 2024, demanded, and I quote, "that Israel brings to an end without delay its unlawful presence in the occupied Palestinian territory, which constitutes a wrongful act of a continuing character entailing its international responsibility, and do so no later than 12 months from the adoption of the present resolution." End of quote. That deadline is roughly 2 months away from the recording of this interview. Yet only last month, the United Nations General Assembly adopted a further resolution which was voted for in favour by 149 member states, which, amongst other things, demanded an immediate, unconditional and permanent ceasefire to be respected by all parties, record its demand for the immediate, dignified and unconditional release of all hostages held by Hamas and other groups, and stress the need for accountability in order to ensure Israel's respect of international law obligations. And in this regard, called upon all member states to individually and collectively take all measures necessary in line with international law and the Charter of the United Nations to ensure compliance by Israel with its obligations. In this episode, we have the pleasure of being joined by His Excellency Amar Hijazi, Ambassador and Head of Palestine Mission to the Kingdom of the Netherlands, Permanent Representative of the State of Palestine to international organizations in The Hague, who will reflect on his role as ambassador, the importance of pursuing justice within existing international legal mechanisms, as well as the need for states to show commitment to international law. Your Excellency, thank you for joining us. Could you begin by describing to us your current role in a bit more detail, as well as telling us a little bit about your journey leading up to this position and your early encounters with the field of international law?
Thank you very much. Thank you again for having me. It's a pleasure to be here in this renowned institute and happy to participate in this podcast. Well, in relation to my position here, I basically wear two hats. One is related to the bilateral relations with the Netherlands, and at that level, we are not yet recognized as a state, but we have the responsibility to advance bilateral relations. We enjoy almost full relationship with the Netherlands, and we're building relations at all levels, including with the government, with the parliament, churches, non-governmental organizations, and trying to reach mutual understanding over the issues that relate to Palestine, the question of Palestine, but more so at the international level and issues that are of mutual interest. So that's the first hat. The second hat is as the representative of the State of Palestine to international organizations, including courts that are domiciled in The Hague. And that is the responsibility to represent Palestine before international courts, including the ICJ and ICC, but as well as the OPCW. And in the current state of affairs in which our people are facing erasure and destruction, as well as a genocide, it weighs heavy as a responsibility on my shoulders to follow up and to make sure that these international organizations, as well as the Netherlands as a country that prides itself with implementing and abiding by international law, do uphold and shoulder their responsibilities as it relates to the issues that are happening now in Palestine. As to what led me to this position, well, you know, sometimes it's fate, but sometimes it's destiny. And in Palestine, as a son of a refugee, I learned early on in my life that we are impacted by international law, and we are impacted by the determinations that take place elsewhere, and we might not have a saying over at the international level. But more so when I applied as a junior diplomat to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and got the chance to interact with international institutions. The first interaction was during the year in which we organized the first ever international conference for the high contracting parties of the Geneva Convention, with the aim to ensure that the high contracting parties uphold their responsibilities as it relates to Palestine. And there I saw the amount of resistance when we were trying to legislate and make sure that the obligations are not based only and squarely on political determinations, and whether, you know, you feel good today or you have a good government that decides to do the good thing. It's more so as a legal obligation. And from there on, I paid attention to how much this matters, how much international law matters, and how much the door is sealed before Palestine to enter and to utilize the international legal mechanisms, which sets obligations, and it's not a matter of opinion anymore. Because if it's a matter of opinion, there are big shots and big states out there that can say whatever and do whatever. But when it's law, it's based on fact and law, and thus it becomes an obligation. And therefore, I get more interested. And so my study pursued that, but also my career as a diplomat at our mission in the United Nations, and then as the Assistant Minister of Multilateral Affairs, following international institutions and international law and all the things related.
Turning now to international legal obligations and unavailable international mechanisms, we meet today to reflect on the International Court of Justice's advisory opinion of the 19th of July 2024. Looking back at this opinion, what are your reflections? How have you seen it influence your work as ambassador in communication with state representatives and fellow members of the international community?
I think, first of all, let's agree that this was historic by all means. The advisory opinion issued by the International Court of Justice in July of last year was a historic opinion, and it set the record straight, meaning that it deals with the root causes of the problem in Palestine, and that is the presence of a foreign domination and occupation on somebody else's land that needs to be ended, and that this occupation is, by that sheer existence and prolonged existence, is committing several categories of violations that are of erga omnes and jus cogens nature, which are the concern of the whole international community. So as such, I think, you know, most of the time when you sit at the political table and you discuss, the power game is somehow played, because in politics you have the ability to influence certain decisions. But when it comes to determinations of law, and that's the beauty of law again, it's not a fleeting matter. It is a straightforward and clear issue. It's not your opinion or my opinion. It is a determination by the highest court on earth, and that is the ICJ, about what is the situation really is, and what are the responsibilities that are on states because of that situation. And as such, it have saved us a lot of talk to states, you know, to readjust the narrative. And most of the time, when countries peddle certain narratives, it's meant to serve certain political aims. And thus, even the court has straightened that narrative and made it easier when you speak. So I don't want to come asking you for any handouts to another state or any other partner at the international level. Now, there is a determination by an international court which sets certain obligations on you as a state and triggers these obligations. And you as a state, you claim to be aligned with international law and with these obligations, therefore have the obligation to abide by these and follow them. And we saw that it triggered a very important discussion, whether it is at the level of states, in which, for example, in the country we are in, the government is almost asked in every debate that concerns Palestine about where they stand in on implementing this specific advisory opinion, but more so at the international level, including at the political gatherings like the EU and elsewhere. So today our discussion is at the level of when are you going to abide by your obligations, instead of speaking about the narrative, who did what and who started the chicken first or the egg first. It's not anymore. Today, these are the determinations and we need to hear back from you on how you are implementing it. More so when certain states try to bypass these obligations, where you can come and say straight that you are violating your obligation. One good example that might not be directly tied to the advisory opinion, but it's tied to obligations of state, is the Nicaragua-Germany case, in which two countries that are far away from Palestine decided to litigate something around Palestine over an obligations that are already delineated under international law and under several bodies of that law. So it shows the level of responsibility, more so at the national level. So citizens, concerned citizens, but more so organizations can also hold governments accountable today based on these determination. So I think it opened the door wide, and yet we have not seen a lot of the results of this advisory opinion, but throughout the years we will see. Some countries are holding back more, some countries have moved on. An example, Spain today is basing its policies and its relations with Israel on the advisory opinion. More and more countries are moving forward in that direction. And we think that we cannot ask for more. All what we are asking states today is to abide by international law, respect their duties as states, and by extension, salvage and maintain what is left of the international law-based system. Because Palestine is today presenting the spearhead in that system and is the litmus test to all states when it comes to that system.
So you mentioned Palestine as a litmus test, and this idea of salvaging what is left of the international law-based system, hinting at concerns felt within the discipline and beyond of what many have referred to as the death of international law. And a key driver of these concerns seems to be a lack of compliance with what seem to be foundational principles of the post-1945 international legal system. And as you mentioned earlier, peremptory norms of international law. Now, we have several proceedings ongoing at the International Court of Justice addressing violations of international law in respect to the actions of Israel in the occupied Palestinian territory. And only a couple of months ago, on the 28th of April, 2025, in a statement during the verbal proceedings in respect to the advisory opinion requested by the United Nations General Assembly on the obligations of Israel in relation to the presence and activities of the United Nations, other international organizations, and third states in and in relation to the occupied Palestinian territory, you stated in a quote, "Israel has been systematically dispossessing, uprooting, slaughtering, and imprisoning Palestinians in absolute flagrant disregard for international law and the inalienable rights of the Palestinian people for 80 years now. It has done so with the intent to destroy our people and to thwart their realization of self-determination in the homeland." End of quote. And then in an interview with Middle East Eye in April this year, you then communicated, and I quote, "We know that Israel will not comply with whatever comes from this court." End of quote. If this is the historical context informing your expectations of compliance with the court's decisions and advisory opinions, some may question going to the ICJ. What would your reply be to those who question whether the international legal system still matters?
Well, I mean, those are the existing bodies already. I mean, and it's an important factor that Palestine was not the one that invented them. Otherwise, they would have said that because we invented them, they are making these rulings in order. They are already accusing them of being biased, anti-Semitic, etc., etc. So, and those, we pay the heavy price of what the international community has determined on Palestine beforehand, which was, if you take it by any standard, illegal. We were not consulted as a people when the partition was taking place. We were not given any opinion. Our own private land was violated and our own private property was, our people was decimated. More than half of the Palestinian people, almost 59%, became refugees between a day and a night because of a decision that an international organization that was created to preserve international peace and security decided upon. And from that day on, we haven't seen any abidance by any norm. In fact, the 181 resolution itself was not abided with. I'm saying that as introduction to why today international legal system matters for Palestine and for the Palestinians, and why do we do that? One is that this system must shore its responsibilities. And yes, the doors were sealed, but we managed to have certain cracks here and there to enter. One, by upgrading our status at the UN to a statehood, in which allowed us to sign up to several international treaties and organization, which allowed us also to admit ourselves as a state to international organizations and have a standing before these organizations. Because before that, there was no jurisdiction, no standing, no admissibility, since we are not a state. So we resolved all of these questions, legally speaking, and factually to a certain extent, because statehood, as we know, in terms of contemporary international law, is recognized mainly by the UN. But there are also other factors to statehood, people, land, and other factors, and those are all existent to the Palestinian people. And the determinations of that land are very well delineated by international law. So what's left is to implement that resolution. We decided to try for 30-something years the peace route. So sitting with an adversary that is much more powerful in terms of arms and in terms of backing from major countries, especially the West and the United States, and so on and so forth, and try to resolve this peacefully. And there was good periods when Rabin was around, but then it went downhill from that day on. And Israel today claims that the whole thing is theirs. You know, it's a God-given right, not based on any legal or factual or any basis for that matter. And we see reluctance from action from states that matter, those who are responsible to, in the first place, who raised their hands in the vote in on 181 that partitioned Palestine. So when the Netherlands decided to raise its hand, it recognized two states. Why does it today only recognize one of these? So that from that day on, there was a legal obligation on the Netherlands to also respect the rights of the other side. Moving forward, and I know that many have lost hope in these mechanisms, but those are available mechanisms. They are not perfect. We never claimed that they are perfect, and they never gave us, we still think that there are shortcomings. You know, there are certain things that could be more said. For example, the evaluation of the system of apartheid that Israel has created. It stayed as obscure, although it says that it is apartheid or racial segregation, but still you could have been more clearer as an international court of justice. This is one example. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, the determinations are grave and instances that are much, much less than what the court has found in the case of Palestine. We saw the international community taking very strong measures. I'll give you another example, Sudan and South Sudan. South Sudan never had a resolution ever in the Security Council or the GA or at any level whereby there is partition or that, you know, self-determination is granted to the South Sudanese. But when the world found that there is a level of oppression and suppression of rights and obligations of the state, they went as far as partitioning a sovereign country, which runs contrary to a certain extent with the Charter of the United Nations. But that was the solution that the world decided. And that was in a short period of time in which the international community paid attention and said, we want to make this determination and went on. What about the country that you have already partitioned in the first few days of the United Nations when it was still in its baby steps? Why do you ignore that? And that is where power interests kick in, which we don't necessarily have so much to push back on. We have international law, we have facts, we have the rights of our people, we have our inalienable rights, which is inalienable to all peoples. It's not specific to the Palestinian people. We want them to be implemented and respected. And it is important, even though I said that Israel will not abide by what the outcome, and we know that Israel have not even abided by 181. They were given 53% of historical Palestine unjustly, and we still think that it is a historic injustice that befell our people, but we deal with it as a fact and as a matter of law today. But unjustly they were given that, and they took on top of that another almost 20% of historical Palestine, and the world was watching, and it was supposed to be the UN and everybody else to make the partition work. And Jerusalem was supposed to be an international city that will have a poll after 10 years in which the people determine to which country they want. And it was 99% Palestinian. So we knew which way Jerusalem was going. So the reality is that everybody was watching international law and international legitimacy as per the GA resolution, trampled upon to serve the interest of somebody that is empowered by certain powers. And the only absent from the table was the Palestinian people. Today we are not absent. Today we can talk, we can walk, and we can represent ourselves. And therefore, going to courts and making sure that states are not absolved of their responsibility. It's almost like a criminal. It's like I come to you and complain about a criminal, and you could tell me that hopefully he will rectify his behavior. That won't happen. I want the police to stand up. And the police in this case is the international community. And they have to uphold their responsibilities as per their obligations under international law and as per the determination by the ICJ, but also the ICC. We see how much states have been flouting their responsibilities, including when Hungary received Netanyahu, a fugitive of justice in Budapest, in defiance of the ICC arrest warrants. I mean, it shows how much states are willing to go to undermine a whole institution. We see the sanctions that the U.S. put on the special rapporteur on human rights just for merely reporting about the situation and pointing to those who are violating international law by not upholding their obligations, including private entities and companies. So now it is obvious they cannot fight this back, no matter how much twisting or gymnastics or talking points they repeat, and no matter how much Western media is tilted towards their narrative, they cannot escape it. The reality is that the law says that this is illegal. This is the base I start with, and it has influenced the discussion. But how much it will be influencing the action? We saw a certain movement, as I said before, but yet we hope that others will follow suit, and we hear more and more voices coming from all angles, jurists, international lawyers, NGOs. People on the streets are calling for, what are the people calling for, those who are demonstrating? They are asking for the law to be implemented, asking their governments. Cases at the national level, so many things are happening based on this determination and the previous determination from the world and so many other determinations that the world have reached. The U.S. and Israel are trying to kill the messenger by boycotting the Human Rights Council or withdrawing from the Human Rights Council, by applying sanctions on judges and the prosecutor. And with God knows what will happen with the ICJ once they will make the next determination on UNRWA. But this is the reaction of bullying. It's not anymore law. Today, you are using sheer power to silence those who are standing for rights. And this is what democracies are supposedly against in the first place. So let's see how things move forward. We will keep pushing for justice to be achieved. And justice in the Palestinian people case is very, you know, relevant, because what is justice? How can I bring back the 60 years of my grandfather's torture in a refugee camp for nothing he did, for no crime he committed, and being buried in a foreign land? How can I return that to him? It's a whole life that was lost in misery and injustice for no crime committed except that somebody else, somewhere else, decided certain thing to this land, and we paid the heavy price, and we still pay up until now. Mm-hmm. And today, we see the final episodes of our erasure taking place in Palestine. These are now very clear in terms of law. Everybody knows where everything stands. And it's up to states. They want this system to continue, or they want it to collapse on the basis of few interests here and there, or on sheer power and bullying. That's a determination that it's not up to the Palestinian. This is why it is a litmus test. Everybody is looking at Palestine. I mean, we are succeeding almost everywhere when it comes to grave violations of international law. You see quick action at the level of Security Council here, there, or even groupings of countries that take measures. Just a few days ago, we heard about more and more and more sanctions on Russia. Then you have the tools, you are willing to implement it based on your determination that there is a legal violation. So why are you holding it back when it comes to Palestine?
Now, Judge Ladley from the ICJ seems to echo a similar sentiment in respect to the international community when he declared, in relation to the ICJ advisory opinion of 2024, and I quote, "The 285 paragraphs of this advisory opinion will be meaningless if the United Nations does not act upon the advice provided by the court to promote the resolution of this conflict, which is a large stain on the claim that there exists an international community. For how can any community permit such indignity and suffering as that imposed on the Palestinian people?" End of quote. Now, you have already explained why pursuing justice through existing institutional mechanisms is important. However, moving on a little now to think about this large stain on the claim that there exists an international community. There are states which have come together in the pursuit of justice and in defense of the international community. And I'm thinking in particular of the Hague Group, founded by 8 states, namely Bolivia, Colombia, Cuba, Honduras, Malaysia, Namibia, Senegal, and South Africa. And in a bold statement on their website, describe themselves as a global bloc of states committed to coordinated legal and diplomatic measures in defense of international law and solidarity with the people of Palestine. The inaugural joint statement of the Hague Group actually ends with a call to all nations to join, and I quote, "in the solemn commitment to an international order based on the rule of law and international law, which together with the principles of justice is essential for peaceful coexistence and cooperation among states," end of quote. Now, you've already mentioned a certain shortcoming of the international legal system, but could you tell us a little bit more about this pursuit of the Hague Group, especially taking into consideration the clarity of calling for a commitment to an international order based on the rule of law and international law, and not, for instance, adopting this other, more recent term, the rule-based international order?
The current system does not come without faults, and I alluded to 181, for example, you know, the early stages of the United Nations, which came after a destructive world wars and genocides and many things that happened in the world, have also done injustice to another people while it was created. I mean, it's not completely perfect. And the Palestinian people, you know, always felt weary of this system because, again, the example of my grandfather, he's a farmer attending to his land, and suddenly somebody claimed that this land is given to him by somebody else. He didn't even read or follow or know about what was going on internationally. And he found himself a refugee without a home, without land, without anything. Although he can account to 6 or 7 great-grandfathers on that land, and that new person cannot account for one, but still, nothing salvaged him, not his land deeds. And so that system produced also certain injustices. But it is the best that we as humanity managed to put in place. And when you look at it, there are very noble causes and very noble goals within that system. If you manage with a group of countries to steer it towards these noble goals, knowing that it might be Palestine today, but tomorrow God knows who, if we allow for might to be right, then you can awaken the interest of other states. And I think, you know, the noble stance that the Hague Group is taking is not coming out of enmity towards a certain side. It's not because they like or dislike. It is because of the gravity and the prolonged nature of these violations that have been taking place for so long, that, you know, it requires that you need to start taking action. And they're not acting outside the realm of international law. If you take international law as an abstract, it needs bodies to implement it. And the bodies of international law, or the tools, or the implementers, are states. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter how much you accumulate resolutions or decisions, or if you don't have the will within states to implement it. But the lack of implementation means that you're deeming this international body irrelevant, and you are self-destructing these international organizations, and thus reverting back to the years where might is right, and, you know, a different setting of international relations, and evoking certain rights that might exist or not exist. I'd like to add Canada to my state. We heard it, right? Coming from an elected president in the United States. That's not allowed. It's a grave violation under international law, and the whole world felt that. Same with Palestine. Annexation is not accepted, as it is not accepted in Canada, as it's not. So why would somebody feel encouraged to say that thing about Canada? Because it was already allowed to be said, and nobody was held accountable. So you think that the trends, the negative trends that run contrary to international law, are also gaining traction. So the best thing is for states to wake up and then stand up and say, oh no, the things are slipping from our hand, and we need to step in and make sure that at least the basic norms, invasion, aggression, annexation, violation of sovereignty, violation, mass violation of human rights, genocide, war crimes, crimes against, you know, are things that we should not have tolerance for at all. And this is where the ones with the noble causes and with, and yes, they will pay a heavy price in terms of interest. We see South Africa has been already sanctioned at so many levels, and we'll see many of these countries somehow sanctioned for the reason that they stood up for international law. We saw judges already being sanctioned for that, and international UN special rapporteur. If we leave and allow for might to take ground, then we are living under a regime in which one state determines what you can do and what you cannot do, dictates how the trade should happen and how the relations should happen, and whether this land is yours and whether these borders are you. It's going to be a mess all over the world. So out of concern for the whole international law-based system, which you said it's a new term, and I agree. Rules and laws as per what? As per the United States or as per international law? We tend to think it is as per international law and international legislation. And those states from that door, and based on the determination of the International Court of Justice, and based on the resolution of the General Assembly, which the International Court of Justice instructed to determine the parameters and how to implement that decision, determined, are basing themselves in their actions on these two backgrounds, but by extension, as I said before, defending the whole international law-based system. That's the essence of what this group is doing. And again, they want to have normal relations with Israel, and they have. In fact, some of them were much, much more closer to Israel than ever being to Palestine. But today they are concerned about the state of affairs, because they have big states next to them, because there are other states that have interests in your territory or in your natural resources. And they saw all of these are being violated in Palestine. So what will stop the other party from violating them in my country? So that's why, again, what puts Palestine as a litmus test to this whole international system. But it is an important to salvage that system from the Palestinian angle, and by extension, to say that states will not sit idle by and watch when these violations are taking place.
In that respect, when thinking about not standing by and the Hague Group's desire to discuss practical action and implementation, what are the practical things in mind here?
The practical things are very clear and straightforward. First of all, you would not recognize as legal the situation arising from the unlawful presence of Israel in the OPT. And from that, so many things will branch. When you don't recognize it, means you don't assist in the continuation of this illegality, abstain from treaty relations in which you consider that territory as part of Israel. You don't enter into trade or economic relations within that relates to that territory in any way, fashion, or make sure that those who are also violating international law and committing crimes on that territory are also held accountable. Make sure that you don't finance or support or give arms for the occupying power to continue its presence in that territory. And, you know, so many actions can branch from that. We can start and we cannot end. The envelope of actions that states can take based on the legal determination of the illegality of Israel's presence in the occupied Palestinian territory is what dictates you to take actions within your norm. You know, that ICJ did not say send armies. So that's very clear. So there are certain actions you don't go as far as doing. And if we look at the example of South Africa, what brought the defunct apartheid regime to its knees is that exactly, is the international community taking a stance towards that regime, not willing to deal with it, and sanctioning it in several ways. And they were not weaker than Israel. They had nuclear weapons. They had a nuclear program, at least, if not weapons. They had one of the most advanced military industries in the world. They were very well off, much bigger land, more natural resources to exploit, and more people to make them work with almost near to nothing. So it was brought to its knees because the world said enough is enough. You cannot continue to subjugate and to discriminate against another people based on race, and you cannot deny them their human rights based on that. And therefore, we take action.
We have focused so far on states as key actors of the international community. But thinking now to Albanese's recent report as the special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967, entitled From Economy of Occupation to Economy of Genocide, I wondered whether you'd mind reflecting a little on the role of corporations and capital in all of this.
Well, I don't claim to be so knowledgeable, but I can, you know, from following the state of affairs and the amount of power that capital is having over elected officials, and, you know, most of their needs are being serviced, is a bit scary to me. We see an infringement, I would say, of capital into decision making at the level. And this is a Palestinian story. We have been facing this a lot because always we are, you know, countries are between a rock and a hard place, whether they go along with international law and respect their duties or lose certain interests and certain gains. One of them is weapons, a very clear example in which countries are buying weapons from Israel, but also selling them weapons, and having this lucrative interest that are not necessarily completely governmental, but, and this is, you know, for the citizens of the world to look into, but it does influence. And what Francesca did in her report is extremely important because it's highlighting a phenomena as it relates to Palestine today, but this phenomena is worldwide. What she did is a whistleblowing against those companies. And you know, as citizens of the world, we have an obligation to boycott first out of obligation, but also as governments and as international bodies, they need to be held accountable. And as Palestinians, we will certainly at a certain point pursue them for their violations against our people and ask for reparations and restitution and for everything they did. So it's better for them to cut their loss and pull out from the occupied Palestinian territory. One good example is the exploitation of natural gas, Palestinian natural gas. Today, you have many international companies, which we have wrote to and told them that you are in violation of our rights in our territorial water. You cannot do this and you cannot do that. But it's a matter of time. I mean, we cannot open everything at once.
Do they reply?
Some do. Some withdrew and did not want to have part, but some continued. So it's sick. And at the end of the day, I mean, how is it different from drug smuggling? You're making a little bit of money, but you're killing a lot of people, you know, getting wealthy quickly. It's the same. but, you know, with a better tie and name.
Coming to a close now, and thinking about what we've considered here in respect for a need for the international community to stand up against violations of core principles of the international legal order, stand up for people subjected to suffering at the hands of states, where are you now in hope for the future, for Palestine and for Palestinians?
Well, I think we are at a very dark chapter of our history. But again, I mean, I just want to answer for the hope part of it, because, you know, being unhopeful is a luxury that few can attain. We cannot have that luxury of being unhopeful and sit down and say, you know, the world is a mess, let's not do anything. So that's not a choice for the Palestinian people. We have to stay hopeful, and we are hopeful. We have so much trust that the arc of history is going to be rectified. New generations that we saw in the streets of all over the world are giving us hope. We see hope in many people that we meet, in many principled positions coming from governments, from NGOs, from principled persons, from retired politicians. Every aspect of that is giving us hope, and we are forever grateful for these people. But yes, it is a very dark chapter in our history that seems to be, you know, just getting darker by the day. Every time we say they have reached the bottom, we discover that there is a new depravity that they can come up with, including the last episode of Hunger Games that they are playing with the people, shooting them and killing them. Already over 600 or 700 have been killed, just, you know, trying to go get a package that will last 3 days. Mm-hmm. So you have to do this trip twice a week and hoping that you come back alive. Somebody is sick enough to implement that kind of strategy, and yet they call it humanitarian. So it is a very dark chapter of our history, and we will keep fighting, we'll keep exposing, we will keep doing everything in our effort to not absolve anyone of his responsibility in order to stop this genocide and to end the root causes of this problem, which is Israel's illegal presence and occupation in the occupied Palestinian territory, which will lead to our, you know, independence and freedom. What we are fighting for is freedom, and not to go into another cycle of violence, you know, a little rest and then violence, which is, you know, funded and sustained by big powers. Israel by itself cannot stand. And we are not given even an equal footing to fight back equally. It's so unfair that we are being subjected to this kind of treatment. But we have hope. We see the arc bending. We see the lies not standing water anymore. We see that they are being exposed more and more. Even the closest of their allies and people who used to come out on TV and elsewhere in the West to defend their criminality are no more willing to do that, because there is no more defense that you can put. We see people more and more reading about the history of the conflict and discovering that they were completely misunderstanding the whole thing. So maybe not in a few months and not in a few years, and we might unfortunately see more of this genocide going on, because the genocide people are focused also on Gaza, which is being covered, but it's also extended to the West Bank and everywhere the Palestinians exist. But we will keep fighting, and we will do our role. And just like our grandparents and parents, we will carry the torch to our children. Palestine has been there for 14,000 years, and it will continue to be there. And one day, our children or ourselves, we will enjoy our freedom in the independent state of Palestine without genocide, without apartheid, without discrimination, without fear of for our children that they will return home or not, without fear that our home will be taken or not, hoping that to live in peace and security with our neighbors and to have time to heal, because we did not get a chance for a long period of time to heal. And we are hopeful. That's what we work for every day in, every day out, not out of spite, because we are one of the most kindest people on earth. We don't carry hate, because it weighs us down, and it's a dirty load to carry. we carry hopes in the future, and that's what keeps us light and moving, and that's what we hope for, and to live in peace and security with everyone who is willing to also live in peace and security. We hope also that the misery and the killing and the destruction in Gaza, countries move faster than they are, because it's in the hands of countries at the end of the day. People are trying, and people said their word in the millions around the world, including in the Netherlands. And it's time for countries to heed their call. Otherwise, we think that they are doing disservice to themselves, but to humanity as a whole.
Thank you, Your Excellency.
Thank you.